Welcome to the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, where you learn the best doubles strategies to improve your game and win more matches. I'm your host, Will Bocek. This podcast, my website, and my weekly newsletter all focus on the goal of better understanding the sport of doubles and helping players like you improve faster through actionable advice that you can use in your very next match. My goal is to provide the best doubles strategy resources in the world. And to do that, I study, analyze, and work with players at every level of the game, all the way up to the ATP and WTA tours. If you enjoy this podcast, I've created double strategy products that go even deeper if you want to take your doubles knowledge to the next level. At the end of this episode, I'll explain more about them, or if you want to learn more now, go to thetennistribe.com/products. Here's today's episode. Today, you're going to hear my conversation with Rob Morgan. Rob is the coach of Wesley Kuhlhoff, who just won Wimbledon alongside Neil Skubsky. This is the second time in about a month that I've spoken to the coach of the world's number one doubles player. So if you missed the episode a few weeks ago, I spoke with Phil Farmer, who was coaching or is coaching Austin Krajicek, who was at the time world number one. But now after Wimbledon, Wesley Kuhlhoff is world number one, and I'm speaking with his coach, Rob Morgan, here today. So Rob has over two decades of coaching experience. He has worked with singles and doubles players on the ATP and WTA tours. He used to work with Joe Salisbury and helped he and Rajiv Ram win Grand Slam titles. He's helped players win 20-plus ATP and WTA Tour titles, and is one of the top doubles minds in our sport for sure. And this is a really in-depth, deep conversation about communication. So some of Rob's answers to these questions really surprised me, especially early on as we kind of dive into what it took to win Wimbledon. So Neil Skubsky and Wesley Kuhlhoff have been the best team for the last 18 months, but have not won a Grand Slam until last week at Wimbledon. And I asked him, what was different? What did they do different this year to kind of get over that hump, even though they had won so many titles, non-major titles already? We talk a lot about communication on the doubles court. We talk a lot about his role on the team of the world's number one doubles team. And then we ask a lot of, or dive into a lot of your questions as well. So a couple hours before this episode, I posted on Twitter and Instagram to get some questions from you, and I'm able to ask those, like how we should be using signals on returns, top three questions to ask someone who you're playing doubles with for the first time. What's the most neglected aspect of doubles that club-level players miss? I really liked that answer a lot. And then we go over a volley drill that I filmed Wesley and Rob working on back in Montreal last year in 2022. So I show that to Rob, and he kind of talks us through the drill and how you can implement it into your own game. So this is a really wide-ranging, really fun conversation. Like I said, we dive deep into doubles. Of course, I ask the rapid-fire questions at the end, like his favorite books, tournament, and how to make doubles more popular as well. So without further delay, enjoy this really fun, deep conversation on double strategy with Rob Morgan. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. Today, we have Rob Morgan on. Rob is the coach of Wesley Kuhlhoff, who just won Wimbledon. Rob, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Will.
So you said you just got back home yesterday from Wimbledon. How was the experience? How was the champions dinner? How did everything kind of pan out? Obviously, winning Wimbledon is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, it was a pretty surreal experience. It's having won Grand Slams with players in the past, it's felt good, but the home slam kind of just felt that little bit more special. It was an extremely focused few weeks, so there wasn't an awful lot going on apart from courts, home, coffee shop, courts, home. I actually, when I left yesterday, I got picked up and taken to the train station, I just went past the coffee shop and I was thinking to myself, well, that was the only time I've been past the coffee shop since I've been here at Wimbledon. We've been so on it with everything. So, it was really fun. Definitely the players and the rest of the team, the coaches and stuff need a little bit of rest now just to let everything sink in. But it was amazing. The Champions dinner was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. So Wesley and Neil have been probably the best team. I mean, they've been the number one ranked team for the majority of the past 18 months. But to this point, they had no majors. They made the finals of the US Open last year. Was there anything that they or that you as a team approached differently this time that kind of got them over the hump? Or do you feel like it was just a matter of time and they got unlucky a few times in the past? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. The start of 2022 was obviously the beginning of their partnership. Mm-hmm. And they started that year with, I think, two titles back to back, two 250s. And that year seemed to be a very, very fast year. They won a lot of matches, three Masters Series and four other titles, seven titles in 2022 and 10 finals. So there was a lot that happened in that first year. And obviously we made the Slam final in the US, losing out to my previous team, Jeremy Rajiv. It was a new experience as a team in a Slam final. Wesley had made a Slam final prior to that back in 2020 at the US. Mm-hmm. He actually beat Jeremy Rajiv in the semis who I was working with them at the time. Mm-hmm. So finishing up in Turin was a year that lots of positives. They finished one as a team and as individuals. And we can look back on that year and say, great, good job. You know, we've finished world number ones, you know, fantastic, and just continue. Or, you know, we can look back at the year and go, really good, well done, but what are we missing? And the biggest thing was the Slam. Mm-hmm. So we placed a lot of focus at the beginning of this year on how we were going to see the year, view it as a team. And we were going to view the tournaments like the ATP 250s and the 500s more as, of course, you want to go in and win those events, but more as developmental weeks. Hmm. So if there's stuff that we need to practice and it needs to be real, we're going to do it in those events. And if we lose, we lose, but we learn. Basically just trying to work up to a peak in the Masters 1000s and in the Slams ultimately, which was the biggest goal. So there was a lot of focused practice during tournaments, rather than going into each event with the sole purpose being to win it. You know, really scrutinizing each other as a collective and as a team to get better, so we can be our best for the Slams.
Is there a particular skill or strategy as a team that they worked on in a particular tournament that comes to mind that you can share?
Absolutely.
I mean, names of like teams that they lost to that they could have beaten, but just any particulars that you can share?
Yeah. So, I mean, in my view, and I'm sure most of the doubles teams would agree, there's probably seven or eight teams that can win Slams. I mean, look at the teams that have won the Slams this year. It's three different teams. So anyone can win within the top. So it wasn't necessarily about tennis specifically. Mm-hmm. It was more about communication, how we can communicate better on and off the court to bring the best out of each other and as a team on and off the court. So therefore, in situations of pressure, in situations of high priority and high importance, we can communicate better than anyone else, because we're Neil and Wes and the rest of the team, myself, Ken, Neil's brother, agree that they have such great tennis brains. We just need to get them to link a little bit more together on the court. And when you see teams dominate or win a slam and do very well, that's usually the team that is connected the best in big pressure situations, because they're communicating very well. They understand exactly how the other person's feeling at one time. So they know whether to step up or whether to kind of let them run and catch fire. So it's a very important skill, and that comes with time. The development of the team chemistry, even though it's always been very good, it's gone from very good to great over this past 6-7 months this year. So we knew something big was coming, and we believed it. The belonging, the sense of belonging was definitely there. And unbelievably proud to say that both Neil and Wes managed to make it happen at Wimbledon.
Interesting. So I wasn't expecting you to say communication was the difference, but with that, so obviously there's communication off the court and on the court. Is the thing or the difference, I guess, for them this year, or the thing that they've improved in terms of communication, both of those things? Or is it like after a point, like, okay, next time that happens, I'm going to shift here, or do you want me to do this, or do you want me to cover that for you? Or is it like watching film after the match and kind of studying it together and communicating, next time in the situation we'll do this? Talk a little bit more about like some of the specifics.
So every part of what you've just said is vital, is super important. And we have tackled all of those areas to make them go from good to great. But ultimately, the biggest one that had the most impact was on the court during the match, problem solving together. And post-match, how are we going to be next match based on what's happened today, good or bad? Are we going to continue? Oh, that was great. I loved how you were today. I thought you were fantastic under pressure. Your physicality was amazing. You know, I could hear you behind me when we won a point. You know, you sent a great message, for instance. That could be something. And it could also be, you know what, I'm actually feeling not great today. Can you, you know, just letting you know, I might not be hitting my forehand quite as well. So the other person knows. So they can then step up and do a little bit more. And that's the beauty of working the team, is you win and lose as a team. You don't win and lose as half individually, you know?
Right.
Irregardless of who plays better on the court, you or your partner, you win and lose as a team. It's two of you going through. So it's understanding the real team dynamics. And for the listeners that, you know, the club players, I think I would bet there's a heavy majority that go, oh, I played great, but my partner couldn't make a ball today.
Yeah.
Or whatever. So I think it's super important to understand bringing the best out of one another and understanding how you're feeling. And understanding that your role might have to shift a little more and do a little bit more on the court, depending on how your partner's feeling. And that is completely normal. And the best teams do that.
Yeah. It sounds like part of that is also going to be kind of getting in touch with yourself and knowing when you're like not feeling great and being comfortable communicating that to your partner. Cause I know, I don't know, just as you were saying that, I was thinking about myself for like a lot of times, even if I'm not feeling great, sometimes I won't tell my partner that, and I'll just try to like push through it and like put my head down. And maybe that's like not the best thing for the team in a lot of scenarios. So that's really, really strong advice there.
I think with that, it's got to be communicated before you go on the court. So let's say me and you are playing. Mm-hmm. We've had no experience of playing, you know, on the same team together. And let's just say, I say to you, my backhand, just as an example, is feeling awful today. Like, I might be making it, but I don't feel like I'm doing anything with it. I'm actually feeling like running out on the second serve return, I'm going to cheat and kind of edge round early, try and take a forehand. Mm-hmm. And you might go, oh, okay. And kind of shrug it off as to like, why has he just told me that his backhand's not feeling very good? Like, why didn't you just say to me, I want a forehand? Like, why doesn't he make it a little bit more positive? And it could put a down on you if you haven't interpreted my communication very well. So there has to be a plan for the plan.
Mm-hmm.
So pre-match, pre-tournament, you know, start of the year, we collectively get together. This is what we're going to work on. Bang, bang, bang. And it might need reaffirming at some point. You bring it back in. Just remember that conversation we had. Are we still okay with communicating like this? Yes. Da, 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 da. If it hasn't been great, I thought we said we agreed. Yeah, we agree. Okay, next match better. Brilliant. You were great today. Go again. And it moves. It fluctuates because no one feels the same every single day. Yeah. Everyone's mood. You might wake up on the right side of the bed. One day you might wake up on the wrong side of the bed. So that complete, it's almost like a little bit of vulnerability, really, to just opening up and feeling comfortable with someone and a team that you can communicate like that. So it's not just, I'm going to say it. It's got to be a discussion because everyone is going to interpret things slightly differently.
Right. Yeah. How are we going to handle it when it goes well? How are we going to handle it when we're not feeling well? So I wanted to get into a little bit of kind of more specific match prep and kind of your process and your role during the tournament. Going into the Wimbledon final, I believe I have this correct. So they had played Granollers and Zabaios twice before at the French Open the last couple of years and lost. So they were 0-2 against them. Obviously, that's on clay, different surface, different tournament. How did you prepare specifically for this final? Did you use any of the footage from those matches or data from those matches to prepare? Or do you feel like the surfaces are too different and you really focused more on yourselves? Talk a little bit about the preparation leading up to the final.
The preparation was very, very, very similar. We did use video footage from the last match at the French, not the first one that they played, as it was too long ago. We wanted a more recent one.
Sure.
I think anyone that watches tennis knows that every single tennis player has tendencies. So those tendencies will always, almost always stay the same at big moments. And I can't sit here and say that we discussed anything other than that because it's the tendencies of players will always be the same because they have strengths and they back their strengths at that time. It's not as if someone's going to completely change their game to do something different. Okay, you might get the odd one here and there. You might account for that 2 on 10. And if someone does it 2 on 10 and wins 100% of those points, then guess what? You clap and say, well, too good, keep going, you got to do it more.
Right.
So we adopted that approach as we do with every single match. They've been around a long time, Granada Zabaya, so, and they've played a number of different teams that we've watched. Also, I had a lot of experience against them with my previous team with Joe and Rajiv. There was a lot of matches that they played against them. So there was a lot of info that we had. But ultimately, going into the final of a slam, it's not necessarily about how you think that your opponent's going to play. Of course, it's good to have the information, but it's going to be about what you do. And you are going to go out there and you're going to back your strengths all the time. everyone can play that's in the slam final. And it's just who is able to step on that stage and perform the best on that day. Tennis is secondary. The performance, what I mean by that is what the buzz is like down your side of the court. How positive are you? How ready are you? How focused are you on being proactive off the ball? How well are you communicating? Because the tennis will always follow. These are world-class tennis players. And like I said, there's a good eight teams that can win slams, I think, on any given week. So It's about how you step up to the plate as performers more than anything else.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I sent out a message and got some questions from some listeners, and one of them was, how often are you coaching during a match? So obviously coaching is allowed on some level now. So talk a little bit about that. What information are you communicating to the team during a match? Are you the type where you like have an iPad and you're tagging, or are you just kind of getting a feel for the match and trying to motivate the team? Talk a little bit about what goes on for you during the match.
One thing I'm not doing is tagging during the match. The only thing that I will do, depending on how immediate I want to give the feedback to Wes, is a little bit of charting here and there, but I haven't got an iPad out. I'm just doing old school pen and paper, but that's
basic,
very minor stuff on a specific thing. So for example, as I said about the development weeks, there's 250s, 500s. I was focusing on one thing, especially at the 250 in Hettogenbosch with Wes, which was his first serve percentage. And I was charting that. So immediately after the match, I could quickly take the 2 minutes to work out the percentage in and win. And then I'll ask him what he thinks before I give him the answers and see how accurate it is. It's quite a fun little game that we played afterwards, which he enjoyed. And then he's got that information straight away. But the majority of the time, it's more about feeding them energy, feeding them an energy that isn't always necessarily being heard from the box, even though sometimes that might happen. It's more about them seeing the total engagement of the full team. They're engaged with each other. They're engaged with us if they feel like they need it. And if they ask, so if Wes will ask me about something, he'll look at me and say, what do you think of X? I've got to be ready to feedback on that instantly. But it's very short and sharp bits of information, because you're not going to give them a full spiel, because that's it's just not appropriate at that time. When you're on the tennis court, it's very short feedback that you're saying to yourself. And that's the short feedback that you need from a coach at that time.
Right. Yeah. I imagine that's a skill kind of in itself, to be able to deliver like the most important information possible in like 15 seconds or even 5 seconds less. Sometimes.
Yeah. So it's got like literally 3 to 5 seconds.
Yeah.
So for example, one thing that I said to Wes at Wimbledon in one particular match was his first serve was going in the net a little more than what I know he would have wanted. So I literally just shouted, stay tall on your serve.
Yeah.
Stay tall. So then he'll just look, nod.
Yeah.
He knows what that means, because we've already spoken about that in practice. In practice, I'm not going to say to him, Wes, make sure you keep your left arm up for exactly 2 seconds, drive your legs and explode up to the ball and make perfect contact at the top. Therefore, the ball's going to go up and over the net and land in perfectly. I'm going to say to him, stay tall, be up. Yeah, be up on your serve a little more. Job done, like that, in and out.
Yeah. How accurate was he on the first serve percentages when you asked him after the match? No.
In Hettogenbosch? Yeah, very good, actually. There was one match where he wasn't great. There was one match where he was more off than others, but
Okay.
He was about 10% off in that one, but the others, he was literally within about 2 or 3%.
Wow.
Yeah, no, he's very good. He's very, very in tune with that sort of stuff. So I was actually quite impressed. There was a number of times where I said to him, what do you think? And he said, like, I don't know, 68%. And I looked at him and I went, yeah, it was actually 67.6%. So we're going to round that up, and that's 68%. Well done.
Jeez, that is impressive. Yeah. Talk a little bit about how the team works. So you're working with Wesley, and then Ken's working with Neil, and then I know Louis Caeve was in the box as well. How does that team dynamic work during a tournament like Wimbledon?
So Louis works for the LTA, the Federation, and he will help certain players. So he'll help Neil, Joe, Salisbury, Lloyd Glasspool, and the other people that are at tournaments, as more of like a consultant role in that sense, because obviously they're British players under the British Federation. Mm-hmm. Ken works for himself and works for Neil. Ken is the main priority coach for Neil. Louis supports that. And it's just me with Wes. I do everything with Wes. At the tournaments, another team behind the scenes, me, Ken, Louis, all communicate if we're all present. If it's just me and Louis, then it'll be just me and Louis that communicate. If it's just me and Ken, so on and so forth. So yeah, we'll talk about anything regarding the team, what needs to be seen as a priority, what we believe could be better, what we believe is going really well, and that we think we should prioritize. And from an individual standpoint, we'll take our own individual with our players. So sometimes I'll do an individual with Wes, one-on-one stuff, just me and him.
Yeah.
Neil will go off and do an individual with Ken. And that way, it's actually quite a nice dynamic, because that way you do have some space from your partner, which I think is important. And then when you do come together, you feel that something is going really well, they've been working on something or whatever. So it's quite a nice dynamic.
So I wanted to ask about your story. Talk in like 2 or 3 minutes, how you got started in tennis to coaching on the tour and where you are today.
So I started playing tennis when I was 5 and a half. Started taking it, I would say, quote unquote, seriously at probably age 12. I moved from one end of the country to another, which is where I live now. I played tennis internationally since I was basically 12 to 17. And then got a minor injury, which put me out for a small amount of time. Ultimately did some coaching in that time, really enjoyed it, decided that I wanted to pursue a coaching career from the age of 18. And then I basically did my level 1, 2, and 3 LTA courses within a year. And then kind of thought to myself, I'm actually really enjoying this. I want to take this seriously. I then coached at the local performance center, which was down the road from me, which is where I used to train when I was younger. From there, I moved back down south to coach another international high performance center down there. I was there for 4 more years, and then I got an opportunity to work with a British player called Jay Clark. He basically asked me to do 2 weeks with him in China for 2 challenges. I left my job for that because I was employed. So I thought, if I'm going to take a chance on myself here with getting on a tour, which is what I always kind of knew I wanted to do, I've got to leave this job.
Was that a pretty tough decision or was it?
Yeah. Yeah. It was tough.
Yeah.
And in all honesty, great place, great people there. So, which made it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah.
And I was on a salary there. So, you know, everything was there, but I knew I had to take a risk at some point. I just remember, I'll try and keep this bit short, but I just remember at the time I literally had no money to my name. I was, £300 in the bank, nothing else. I had a small little Toyota Yaris, and I had a flat where I lived, and put all my stuff in my car, went to the tennis center, told my boss I was leaving, got hairdryer treatment for 5 minutes, left, went up north, dropped my stuff, went down to London, got my Chinese visa, and then within a few days I was in China.
Wow.
Jay won that tournament. His first tournament, it was the biggest tournament he won. It was a 125 challenger. Beat about three top 100 players at the time on his way to winning it. And after that week, he offered me weeks all the way through to the US Open.
Oh, that's awesome.
So the risk kind of paid off. Then when I was at Wimbledon with Jay, he had a good Wimbledon. He won his first round. Then he played Federer second round. Obviously, he lost that second round, but great experience for him. And Heather Watson approached me. She offered me more weeks, bigger, better gig, basically. Mm-hmm. So I took that, and then I was with her for 6-7 months. And then the same thing happened with Joe and Rajiv. And I was with them for 2 years. And then I decided that relationship was at its max. Even though we had an amazing time together, won a couple slams and some mixed slams in there as well. Mm-hmm. I was ready for a new challenge. I actually didn't have anything lined up at that point. Just made a decision that I wanted to take maybe some time just to think about things. And during that time, Wes approached me.
Okay.
And we're here now.
And then you've got your academy as well. I see you've got the shirt on. Talk a little bit about the academy. That's something you started with your brother, right?
Yeah. So it's M2 Performance Academy. We're a small academy based in Preston in the northwest of the UK. Uh-huh. It was almost like we kind of stumbled on it, really. We always knew we wanted to do something together. Initially, it was going to be like a mentoring thing that we wanted to start up to help players who basically had no money in the local area that wanted to get better and grow their team one way or another. And then we thought to ourselves, well, we might as well just go the full hog and just go for the full academy thing. Is one day we're going to do it. Why not do it now? Mm-hmm. So that's been open now. We opened May 2022, so just over a year and a bit now. Okay. And yeah, we're doing amazing. We're at capacity at the moment, player wise, and we've poured our heart and soul into it. It's the family business with family values, and we want to help everyone that comes our way. So it's something that we both have a good amount of skin in the game with it, and it's our passion basically within our own setup. So it's I'm really excited about the future with that.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I wanted to ask about, you said it at the start of 2022, you started working with Wesley. Mm-hmm. What is your general kind of approach when you start working with a new player? Is there like a checklist or like a process you kind of go through to get to know the player on a really deep level and figure out kind of where you can improve? Talk a little bit about how you would go about that.
Yeah, I think that's a good, really good question. I think every coach is different. I think you have to spend quite a bit of time with a player to really get to know them, not just on the court, but off the court. You're going to spend a lot of time with that player. So you're going to have to get to know them in more than one way. Mm-hmm. Both as an on-court personality and off-court personality. And with over time, you see trends that you know you can maybe bring the best out in them with. But initially, going into that working relationship, which is what I've done with a few players now, my starting point, and maybe I'm giving away one of my biggest secrets here, but You heard it here first, so some exclusivity for you.
There we go.
I get the player. It's not an easy task, this, and it does take time. So you've got to be patient as a coach. But I get the player to write what I call a desire statement. A little bit like a mission statement, but slightly different. You're writing everything about your tennis career as if it's already happened, and you're looking back at it.
Yeah, that's smart.
And when you get a player to do that, because you've got to sell that to them, because you can't just say, you're going to write me a statement about how you look in 30 years and look back. They might come back with a paragraph.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not deep enough. That's not going to cut it. Like, you need to go deep into detail here, and you need to really see what you want and take as long as you want to write this, but don't come back to me with something that is half-assed, because I'm not here to do a half-assed job with you. So they take some time and they write, and I'm not going to say what's involved in their things, so that's private.
Yeah.
But one thing that I will say is that every player that I've done it with, they have succeeded at it, whether it's right off the bat or whether it's where they are now. And it's a really good reference point for you to go back to, because they'll write it, they'll leave it, and nothing will be said for a while. But at a time where you feel like you need to go back and say, I want you to go read what you wrote, that's when it hits them. And then they go, okay.
Yeah.
And then they might get better, or whatever, push harder, whatever it may be, or feel like they're on the right track. But the most powerful thing about that task is it's come from them, nobody else. Hasn't come from you as a coach. It's come from them. They are the drivers of their destiny, ultimately. And as your job as a coach at the highest level, your job is to bring the best out of them, even if it's just by 1%. Because the guys and the girls at the top of the game, they'll rip your arm off for 2 or 3%. That's all the difference is, right? Top.
Yeah.
So that's a big, big part of what I do at the start of a working relationship is that.
It sounds like a good exercise for really anybody who wants to improve, whether it be in tennis or anything, really. I like that a lot. What is something specifically that you feel like Wesley is better at now than he was when you started working with him? Something about his game?
Serving and volleying.
Okay. Anything specific, like more power on the serve, or he's able to mix it up more?
Serve is, he's got more belief in it now because he's more, a little bit more technically refined. Tweaked a couple of things here and there. Not major things, minor things, but they make a big, big difference.
Sure.
And volleys wise, in general, I think a lot more competent as well, technically and tactically. He's always had a very good tactical brain, so he does understand a great deal about the sport, obviously. But it's more of an intent that has improved with his volleys to help him tactically.
If I asked Wesley what your best asset as a coach is, what do you think he would say?
He's always trying to get more out of me.
Okay. Say more about that.
When he gets to a new level of something or has progressed at something, I change the standards.
So he hits a goal higher. And you reset the goal.
Go again.
Yeah.
But now do it like this.
Okay.
And it's not always easy to have that about you as a coach. I think a lot of people doubt themselves. And I say that because I'm pretty confident as a person, but there's definitely been times where I doubted maybe challenging the standards with that. But I know it's the right thing to do, because you say whatever it is, I don't know, let's say it's a service partner volley off a return, for instance. Let's say it's improved and they're doing it really well. And you go, oh, that's great. You've improved so much at that. You know, the stats show that when you touch the ball, you're winning 90% of the points now instead of 70, just as an example. How do you feel? How do you feel it's going? Yeah, great. I feel really good. Okay, brilliant. Park it the next day. Okay, now I want you to do this. See if you can not allow anyone to touch the ball when after you've touched it. Can you get it to go one bounce and off the court on an angle, for instance, just as an example? And they might go, yeah, but I feel like I'm doing it pretty well already. You're like, yeah, you are, but there's another level. Like, you know, I thought we discussed yesterday that I was doing it really well. Yeah, you are, but there's always more. And trying not to engage in like a tit for tat is quite tough. So you've got to have the right way of delivering it and find the right time to deliver it, because it's not just every day something new, because the relationship ain't going to work. You've got to make your delivery very thought out, and take a lot of care with that, with how you deliver something when you're trying to raise the standards a little bit more, even if the standards are exceptional.
How do you decide, like with the volley example, how do you decide when it is good enough? Like when, okay, we're there, we need to work, like we need to maintain this level for our serve plus one volleys, and we need to start working on returns because that's the next thing on our list. Or no, we need a little more time here before we move on. How do you make that decision?
Well, I always base it off where it holds up in a match. Is it holding up in the biggest matches against the toughest teams? Yes or no. Is it holding up on every single surface? Yes or no. Is it holding up against different types of players? Yes or no. Two back as returning team. Are you able to clean the net doing that? Are you able to clean it versus one up, one back? Are you able to clean it versus one up, one halfway back? Sorry, one halfway back, one back. Are you able to do it against a lefty? You're able to do it against a righty. You're able to do it where there's two forehands in the middle. Like, so many things that you can do. But what I tend to do is focus on the most important and the most common things. So the most common things are usually one up, one back. From a first volley, if we're using the first volley as an example, as a service partner. And the most important things is it holding up on break points, game points?
Yeah.
Sudden death juice points in tiebreakers, in the championship tiebreakers in ATP events? And is it holding up in slams?
Or to determine if it's holding up, are you using a lot of data, or are you just kind of, it's something you can see and kind of go back to the film and watch?
I don't necessarily always use like numbers with that. I will watch the film and watch the film, or have it in my mind when I'm watching the match.
Yeah.
And I'll say to myself, well, he's won 9 on 10 when he's touched the ball. Brilliant. Okay. I can tell him afterwards, oh, you've won 9 on 10. And sometimes if I'm unsure of the numbers, it's important how you phrase your interaction with the player. I'll say, I feel as if the numbers are pretty good today. What do you think?
Yeah.
Yes or no? And then we go, but I'm going to check the film later and I'll message you what you got. It's always easy to watch matches back, because film pretty much every tournament, there's a tournament like kind of portal thing that you can use to watch back.
Yeah. So I want to, I've never done this before on the podcast, but I want to share my screen and show you a drill that y'all were doing last year. So I was in Montreal last year. Let me know if you can see this.
Yeah.
You see it? Okay.
Yeah, so I'm whacking balls at Wes here, I think.
Yeah. And you've got two kind of sticks laid out in the deuce in the ad court service box. So, so talk through kind of the point of this drill, what y'all are working on, and even kind of how it might help a club level player as well.
So I am on the right hand side there, feeding, and Wes is at the net. I am acting as the returner. So I'm returning from a relatively offensive point there. So kind of on the baseline, maybe just behind or just inside. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting Wes, we've changed the drill now. Now I'm hitting.
So now he's feeding to different. You. Now he's feeding
to you. Yeah, so this is now. Yeah, this is now going away from server's partner. This is now more of a wall situation. So what we started with, I think I was feeding hard at him, which was server's partner. So there.
Yeah, we'll go back to the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. So these are predetermined volleys that I'm getting Wes to work on, basically having his hands in front and trying to finish on the natural angle of where the ball is coming from and where he can go to. So when I feed to his forehand from the center of the court, I want Wes to hit his forehand into the tram lines on my side, which is where the biggest space is.
Yeah.
When I feed
to his
backhand.
Across his body there.
Yeah, exactly. When I feed to his backhand, I want him to finish off across the court the majority of the time. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's just the easiest way on a fast ball is kind of across your body, but also I'm painting the picture with where I'm stood. So if I'm stood on the tee in the middle, I want him to go to the biggest space. And if I'm stood on the tram lines, I want him to go to where the biggest space would be on the other side of the court, if that makes sense.
Okay. So if the serve were like out wide to your forehand.
Yeah. So if the serve was out wide to my forehand, then I would expect the returner's partner, who was playing up, to get their inside foot on the center tee there.
Yeah, like right in here.
To cover the middle of the court.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the middle of the court. So Wes could finish through there, but it's a little bit cleaner if he's able to finish and beat that net player. Therefore, the ball is going off at a more extreme angle. It's definitely more difficult for them to run that ball down and do anything with it and get it over and in.
Then the drill,
so this is just fast balls. I'm just going hard and fast at Wes here, and I'm getting him to do a little something a little bit similar.
You just missed a few in the net, but I get the idea. Yeah.
We are all human. Oh, there's four in the net. Oh, that's awful. He's laughing about it though.
Yeah. We'll link to this in the show notes for anyone listening. So y'all can watch this too. Okay, so that was more just like a reaction, like during a point drill.
Yeah, so you're training the same principle. Which is having the hands in front and being ready. But we're doing it through two different game situations and two different drills.
Okay. Got it. All right. So I'm going to stop sharing here.
Looks like I need to work on my forehand.
It was kind of cold that day. So I think maybe you just weren't warmed up. there was a little rain delay that day, I think. All right. So a couple of kind of club level questions and then some rapid fire questions, and then I'll let you go. So one of the most common questions I get for club players is how do we beat a team that pushes? How would you think about that?
Well, I'd need to know a little bit more about what do they mean by push.
Probably lobbing.
Lobbing.
So they keep lobbing me.
Okay. Then I would say, as a volleyer, if you are serving and volleying, or if you are playing, this is assuming that they're playing regular formation as servers, one up, one back as a server, because there is some teams that actually play both back in club. when serving, if they don't really don't like volleying, depending on the level. Yeah, I've actually seen that in college tennis, all four players at the back of the court. That does happen.
Yeah, I have too.
Drives me crazy. Yeah, you know what though? Never say never. I wouldn't be surprised if that sort of stuff happens further down the line. I would say as a volleyer, your goal should be to volley short and on angles to avoid giving the baseliners an opportunity to lob. So if you're volleying short and your goal is to either get the ball to die before it gets to the baseliner or get the ball to bounce once and then off the court, at any level, that's tough for the baseliners to run that ball down and do anything decent with. If you're just volleying through the court and floating the ball through the court, there's a good chance the baseliners are going to get behind that ball and chuck it up in the air. So in a nutshell, aim short with your volleys or aim on an angle.
What about, this is something we talked about a little bit earlier with the communication, but one question I get a lot is, how do I win with a weak doubles partner? I think the first step is probably to quit blaming your doubles partner for losing, but how would you think about that? Let's say if the levels are different and there's clearly a stronger player on the court, how can the stronger player win with a weaker player?
It's understanding your role and your responsibility on the court, ultimately, I think. So let's say, as an example, you've got a really good, strong player, and that's you, Will, and a really weak player, and that's me. We really want to win as a team. And you, as a stronger player, have approached the conversation with me in the nicest way possible because you're a great guy. We've had this conversation and you've gone, right, I just want to make sure that we're on the same wavelength here. And we both know that who's better, so you're better. We have a conversation about what our focus is going to be on the court. So, for instance, I'm really slow. So you're going to run down the balls that when we get lobbed, as an example.
Sure.
You're the best server, so you're going to serve first. So you don't go down the break early. I might be weaker overall, but I volley better. So I'm going to play up when I'm returning versus staying back when I'm returning, as a returner's partner, should I say.
Sure.
And it's just understanding that the basics of what you can do and what you can control. Because ultimately, if you say, how do I win with a worse partner? It's a good question. So I'm just going to answer it with the most obvious things. Control what you can control as a team and as an individual. Out of your control that someone's worse than you, but you've made the decision to play with them or you've been put with them. You know, that's kind of there or thereabouts. That's a bit of a gray line, isn't it? So control what you can control on your side of the court. And if you back yourself and you're ready to run a little harder than your partner or whatever it is, then go do it.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, communication's super important. Yeah, I'm always telling people when they ask me that, don't, you know, even if they're a weaker player, they're probably good at something. So like figure out how to hide their weakest weaknesses and then expose their strengths more so that they can hit more of those, whether it's a forehand or backhand or volleys or whatever it might be.
I think with the club players there, I think there's no such thing as like a perfect way of playing doubles. Like not just club players, but every doubles team. Every doubles team has strengths and weaknesses, and it's just knowing what they are. Like I said before, there's tendencies that every top team has, but there's tendencies that every player has. And if you know about your opponents, for instance, then you can use that against them. If you know exactly about what your partner's really good at, you can use that to fuel them and make them feel better about themselves. If they hit something that's great, then you can pump them, feel with confidence, say, that was a great shot, great job, like great positioning or fantastic volley. And when someone feels good, they tend to normally look a little bit better and go about their business a little bit more of a jump in the step. So be the best partner you can be, I think would be a good little addition to that, is try and feel your partner with confidence and find the best in what they're doing on that day. That's quite a big thing, I think, yeah. Which is underrated.
Yeah, definitely. So a couple listener questions. Walter, are you familiar with the USTA ratings? So
the UTR system.
It's USTA has their own system. So he's a 4-5 player, which is probably maybe 7 UTR. Maybe 6-7 UTR. He asked, should I be signaling on returns as well as serves? So it sounds like he's using signals on serves, but not returns. How do you coach or think about return signals?
I think it just depends on what you and your partner prefer. Mm-hmm. Because again, if me and you play and we haven't played together before, I would ask you, do you want me to signal on return of serve for you as a returner? So I'll be returner's partner and I'll be telling you where to go. Do you like that? Or do you prefer me to say nothing? Mm-hmm. And you might say, no, signal. Then great, you signal. It might just be, yes, yeah, signal, but don't tell me where to hit. Tell me whether you're going to stay or whether you're going to go. And that's it. I think it's just very individual for each team and each player. Mm-hmm. It's always worth communicating that early doors.
So Laura asks, what are the top 3 questions to ask someone that you're playing with for the first time?
Which side do you usually play?
Yeah.
What do you want to play? It's a big one. I'm assuming that the majority of the tennis that these players play is outside. Am I correct?
I think so, yeah.
So let's go with that. Do you prefer to serve into the wind or with the wind or into the sun or against the sun? Mm-hmm. That's a big one. Because some people can serve brilliantly into the sun. Some people can't. And some people can't even see the ball sometimes when it gets lost in the sun. So some people completely fall apart depending on that. And I would say, the next one would be, it wouldn't be a question. I would probably say, this is what I'm going to do. Are you okay with that? So if the ball comes, I'm going to play both back on both first and second serve return as a returner's partner. Are you okay with that? Yes or no?
That's a good one. Yeah, that's a really good one. That reminds me. So when I play with somebody new, I like to play really aggressively at the net, which is pretty uncommon at the club level, because people are kind of afraid to get beat down the line, you know? So I'll tell my partner before the match, hey, I play pretty aggressive at the net, so I'm going to get beat down the line some, but I find that they miss 2 out of 3, so it ends up working out. Is that okay with you? Mm. It's kind of a similar thing to what you're saying there. I think that's a really good way to phrase it. What is the most neglected aspect of doubles that club players gloss over? So that's a question from Chance.
That club players what, sorry?
Gloss over, that they miss. So the most neglected aspect of doubles that club players miss.
Smashing.
So they don't practice overheads?
Well. Okay. I don't think many people smash very well at club level.
Yeah.
And that would go back to maybe something that the question before, how do we get better at playing against pushers, people that lob the ball? It would be great if you had a good overhead, then they ain't going to lob that ball back. Like if you had a good overhead, then things would probably be a little bit different.
Yeah.
I would say an overhead.
Yeah, good answer. Pushkar asked, would you like to see more mixed doubles when ATP and WTA are on the same site?
Yes, because I think it's a fantastic opportunity for the doubles players to earn more money.
Yeah, I like that.
And it draws a big, like a big crowd as well. At some events, I mean, doubles, you go to Indian Wells, the stadiums are full with the both doubles, men's and women's. It's an amazing reception there. I think that the doubles players, because they earn such a significant amount less than the singles players, I think introducing something along those lines, whether it's just exhibition stuff, like purely exhibition stuff with a prize, I think would be welcomed by the majority of doubles players, male and female.
Yeah. Okay, so last couple of rapid fire questions. I know we're running a little short on time here.
That's okay.
What's your favorite tennis book?
A favorite tennis book? I've only ever read one, and it's on my bookcase over there. It's the, what's it called again? it's like how to play tennis. Is that what it's called? The yellow book?
Oh, I don't know that one.
You know what? I'm actually going to get it somewhere. Yeah. The Inner Game of Tennis.
Oh, that one. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's the only tennis book I've read, believe it or not.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I haven't actually read any of the biographies. I've got Agassi's book on there, but I haven't read it yet, but I've heard that's really good. But yeah, that is the only tennis book I've read.
Do you have a favorite non-tennis book?
Yes, it's called Red Notice by Bill Brower.
Yeah.
If anyone hasn't read it, I highly recommend it. I'm not a massive reader. I don't read an awful lot of books. I'll read articles and stuff online, but I won't necessarily get my teeth and head into a book that much. But I couldn't put this book down. I read it within, I think, 3 days when I was in China a few years ago. And I was waking up at like 2 a.m. thinking that I've got to read some more. It's crazy. I couldn't put it down. Really good.
So I listen to Audible because I'm just, for whatever reason, not good at reading physical books. And I listened to Red Notice a few years ago, and it was the same way. I finished it in about so probably good. 3 days as well. It's an amazing book.
It's an unbelievable book. Yeah, yeah.
What is your favorite tournament?
That's a tough question. There's so many good ones. I've had so many good experiences.
You can pick three if you want.
Okay.
We can create categories, maybe.
Yeah, Wimbledon. Well, to be honest, my favorite slam prior to this year was always Australia. Because I've had such good experiences there. The weather's always amazing. What you can do outside of tennis is great. It's a great place to be. I love Melbourne. But this year at Wimbledon, I experienced a different side to Wimbledon that was all about the tennis and how it's celebrated. For example, feeling very lucky to be at the winner's ball, to be there with all the great champions and players that were there, just made that quite unforgettable. Then I would say I really like Montreal for the Masters series. I think that was a good one, but I would have to say Indian Wells is probably the best Masters series. Then I would say tournament after that. So we've gone Grand Slam, Masters Series, and tournament after that would be I think Acapulco in Mexico.
I haven't
been to that. ATP 500 matches start at 6 p.m. Sometimes you're finishing at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, go to sleep, wake up at 1, 12.
Yeah.
Your day just starts different. The people, the fans are amazing. It's very lively. There's lots of parties that go on there. It's a whole different kind of way of having a tournament, but it's a pretty cool experience.
That's good to know. Yeah, I think I might have to attend that one next year. I'm not really a morning person, so the idea of matches starting at 6 and going till 2 is perfect for me. So last question for you, how do we make doubles more popular?
Great question. I think it needs to be marketed better. I don't think it's marketed very well at all. The most you'll see of doubles is the occasional hot shot, or if there is 4 singles players on the court.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't agree with that. I think it should be marketed a lot better. So I think, yeah, the marketing of it needs to be improved. But I think there is great things that do happen, such as, you know, this podcast is amazing. There's a couple of other things that, you know, people walk around wearing t-shirts that actually say like play more doubles or watch more doubles.
It's this one.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I created those.
I've seen that. Oh, did you? I've seen that at a number of tournaments, which is great. Oh,
that's good to know. Yeah.
I didn't actually realize that was you.
Yeah.
That's good to see. I think the juniors side, I don't think they play on it enough. Like there's a lot of doubles which counts towards the junior rankings, but it kind of then just stops after that. Obviously, college is big in America. In the UK, the university system is a little bit different, but it is important as well. But then as soon as everyone plays, turns pro, I think it tends to be put on the back burner, maybe because there's less money involved. But if it gets marketed better, then there could be more money available for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. It's a very deep, long conversation. But anyways, Rob, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for reaching out.
To everyone listening, I'll link to the video that we looked at and then everything else in the show notes as well. And I will talk to you all next week. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Doubles Only podcast. If you're interested in diving deeper into any topics I discuss, I've created double strategy products that allow me to bring you more podcasts and other doubles content without relying on paid ads. I have ebooks and courses that help you make better strategic decisions during matches and become the smartest player on the court. Go to thetennistribe.com/products to learn more. You can also join my free weekly double strategy newsletter that includes video lessons and more on our homepage. If you want to connect, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or email me directly, will@thetennistribe.com.